You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wontoku ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te wae marunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā tōru o pipiri. Nau mai, haere mai. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95BFM with me, Justin Wong, and my producer, Louis McAllister, for today, Rāpere Thursday, the 3rd of June. How are you, Louis?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good. I've heard you have been staying up all night, did you?
Yeah, I stayed up to watch the cricket. It was a big match, so I had to stay with
it. How long did you stay up? How late did you stay up?
I don't want to comment on that one.
Fair enough, I guess. But I guess it's time well spent.
Yeah, I mean, watching Devon Conway score a century was worth it.
A century on debut and at Lord's. I'm surely a lot of listeners will be buzzing about that as well.
Surely be a bit patriotic.
Yes, and are you going to watch the second day on day two tonight?
Maybe, we'll see. I'm not sure if I've got the stamina for it anymore.
Let's hope Devon Conway gets another century if we do decide to stay up.
Hopefully.
E haere akine, coming up on the show today, we have our regular updates with Health Minister Andrew Little. The government said urgent reforms are needed for local water infrastructure after a report warned that household water bills could skyrocket to $14,000 in 3 decades if no action is taken. An Australian federal court ruled that the government has a duty to care to reduce climate change impacts for new mine approvals, and the National Party's mental health spokesperson Matt Ducey said there must be urgent action to support individuals suffering from eating disorders. He Aha o Whakaro, let us know what you think on all of this. Tukapā tuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 or Wai Mai Rane, call us on 309-3879. Kua e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki e ni kōrero ano hi pakihiri roki roki marunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and previous shows on the 95BFM website. I tēnā wā tonu. Let's stay off cricket and talk about health.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about mental health advocate Mike King returning his New Zealand Order of Merit medal after he claims that Little has changed to improve mental well-being for young people, updates to the Waikato DHB cyber attack, and nurses' pay negotiations as they could strike next Wednesday should the negotiations fail. Here's the minister. I want to start this week off by talking about mental health advocate Mike King returning his ONZM medal. So what are your thoughts on that?
Look, it's something that Mike King has chosen to do. Mike is, one of the most important advocates we've got on mental health. His work, and alongside the work of others like Sir John Kirwan, actually that allows us as a country to be more open and talk about mental health issues and remove the stigmatisation that often goes with that. He's been absolutely at the forefront of that and been very open about his own lived experience. So he has played an important role. That's the reason he got that recognition, and that doesn't go away, The contribution that he has made doesn't go away. I know he feels disappointed that he wants more support and government support for one of his particular programs. I think that is a separate issue, but I think regardless of what he does with any award that he has received, the truth is that he deserves the recognition.
But if Mike King is returning his medal, do you think that means the government is still falling behind on its progress on mental health?
No, look, we're not even halfway through the 4 to 5 year program that we started in 2019 with the $1.9 billion investment in improving mental health. Roughly $800 million of that is going into things other than the health system, so corrections, education, housing, what have you. And that stuff is now starting to take effect. We know that for mental health is not just a, you know, it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's a response to triggered by life experiences and life circumstances, and so you need to address a whole bunch of other determinants as in addition to, you know, the person who's experiencing it as well. In terms of the major program, the centerpiece of that policy, nearly half a billion dollars going into frontline help for people with mild to moderate mental health issues. We've added about 430 full-time equivalent roles to GP practices and community clinics around the country to assist with that. We're not even halfway through that, but those roles are in place. I think it is starting to make a difference. I've spoken to some people who occupy those roles. I've spoken to people who have used the services of these new roles, and people just tell me what a difference it makes. The other part of the program is upgrading the acute facilities, so people who are, you know, quite seriously mentally unwell. And we know there's huge pressure on that part of the system, and you know, frankly, the system is struggling to keep up. We've got ongoing investment there. I mean, one of the big challenges we've got is getting people trained up and qualified to be able to assist in mental health roles, and we're only partway through that. So, look, I know people... the problems have been around for a long time. People want the fix as quickly as possible, but there is a reality of this. We have to add more people to the mental health workforce. That takes a while. We're doing that, and it is starting to make a difference. But I acknowledge there is a long way to go.
Okay, are there any more announcements on mental health that we could expect?
Yeah, look, there will be some. They'll be at the lower end of the sort of cost spectrum, if you like, not the hundreds of millions of dollars, but there's other stuff that that is about to come on stream that we're doing, and particularly targeted at young people. And I think as we're now to the second half of the phase, I know that some of the feedback we're having is, particularly around these new roles, these health improvement practitioner roles and health coaches, is we're getting other organisations saying, look, we don't have an enrolled patient population, but we offer this service and people drop into us and see us. And look, we may have to look at those sorts of organisations and services and complement them with these sorts of roles and fund those roles for those sorts of organisations. We are looking, you know, over the remaining 2 to 3 years to maximise that spread of available people to be there to help for people when they, you know, suffering that anxiety, low-level depression, those things that, you know, that if we don't deal with them early enough, can cause people to kind of spin out of control, and that's what we're trying to get on top of.
Okay, $1.1 billion that health got in the 2019 budget for mental health, how much has it been spent so far?
$350 million, because it wasn't all spaced out evenly, $350 million was due to have been spent by the 30th of June this year, so the end of this month. $290 million will have been. I mean, unfortunately, in 2020, COVID slowed things down, and it just meant health officials weren't being able to negotiate putting things in place and what have you. That figure might rise a little bit before the 30th of June, but nearly $300 million of the $350 due to be spent will have been spent by the 30th of June. Next, and then from the 1st of July, another big tranche of money, so there's, you know, $500-odd million left to go, and that will continue. I mean, one of the other things that's happened is that the funding for DHBs for their services, and they tend to deal with the acute services, they have what they call ring-fenced funding, so money goes for it. That money can only be used for mental health issues. That has been increasing year on year for the last couple of years, and they get another increase from 1 July. So that stuff is happening as well. But, we are a bit behind, but I'm satisfied with the progress that we're making in the circumstances.
Okay. Moving on to my second topic of this day, it's about the Waikato DHB IT hack. Do you have any updates on that front?
The good progress is being made again. They've got 680 servers that they have to kind of sanitise, reload with data and bring back on stream. The latest report I had was they are about halfway through that. I think we're pretty much half of the servers cleaned, prepped, ready to go. They have to. The process of bringing IT services back on stream is a gradual one. One of the important services is radiation oncology. So they've now got in the process of preparing to bring their radiation oncology services back online. That is totally dependent on their IT services being functioning. It'll be a few more days yet before our patients can be treated at Waikato Hospital, but that is happening. So it's been their systems were pretty much cleaned out in a functional sense. So it's a big job to bring it all back, but they're making good progress in doing it. In terms of investigating the origins of it, I understand there has been progress in terms of better understanding what exactly has happened, but I haven't had a report on that yet, and I'm awaiting that report.
Okay. I know the government said the DHBs will not pay any ransom, but does the government know what the demands are from the hackers?
I haven't received any formal reporting on that. There was a demand. It was ransomware that was installed in the system, and a demand was made. I don't have the details of that. That's very much part of the police investigation, which is ongoing.
Okay. Moving to my final topic for today, it's about the New Zealand Nurses Organisation. They will be having another vote by next Monday to discuss a new pay offer from DHBs. And if that talk fails, there will be another strike on the upcoming Wednesday. So what sort of advice have you received from the DHBs on this?
They worked pretty hard with the nurses' organisation right up until last week in putting together a revised package that they thought would be mean that the nurses would have something else to consider and think about. We know that per nurse pay is, compared to other comparable professions, is behind. That's why there is a significant pay equity process underway that's taking longer than expected. In the meantime, the government's got to look to all across its whole workforce, and at a time when it's got to respond to COVID and pay down the debt that it took on to get through COVID and other things, so things are somewhat constrained. They put out guidance about pay restraint recently. That didn't stop people getting pay increases, but it does mean when negotiating, the escalators are going to be more moderate than might have been expected in the past. Nevertheless, I've seen the work that the DHBs have done with the help of the Ministry of Health and working with the nurses' organisation. So there is a revised offer that has gone out. I understand it's being voted on at the moment. In the end, that's a matter for the nurses themselves, the membership of the New Zealand Nurses Organisation, and we won't know what the result of that is until next week.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi pōho. You're tuning to the Thursday Wire on 95BFM, and that was Health Minister Andrew Little. Don't forget, you can text in your thoughts to 5395 or call in on 309-3879. And the time now is just up to 19 past noon. We will be going on a quick break.
Tell me. Get ready for the General Collective Queen's Birthday Market and Whānau Festival at The Cloud. Grab a coffee and browse the markets while taking in DJs King Kapisi and Tera Moana Rapley, Sandy Mill and Matthew Crawley. Or get stuck in with ceramics painting, sewing workshops, the Go-Go Family Rave with Dick Johnson and much more. The Queen's Birthday Weekend Market and Whānau Festival. Sunday, Monday, June 6th and 7th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at The Cloud, Queen's Wharf. Totally free thanks to Pānuku Development Auckland. General Collective and interesting things.
Listen. Listen to Sigrid's radio show. It's just music, but for 3 hours. Sigrid. Selections by Sigrid. Very good songs. Sigrid. It's Thursday afternoon, 1 to 4. Listen to it. The Thursday 1 to 4 with Sigrid on 95 BFM. Listen live or tune in later on podcast and RSS. It's Thursday afternoon, 1 to 4. Listen, it's just music.
It's
just
music. It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. A report by the Ministry of Internal Affairs has warned that households could face a water bill up to $14,000 in 2051 if New Zealand doesn't upgrade its water infrastructure. The 600-page report, compiled by the Water Industry Commission for Scotland, was released yesterday and said up to $180 billion is needed over the next 3 decades to rehaul the entire water network and tackle years of underinvestment. The report also suggested concentrating water infrastructure ownership is the most efficient way of managing the network, slimming management from 67 territorial or council-owned authorities, such as Watercare in Auckland, into just 1 to 4 publicly owned providers. It also said fewer water entities would result in less variation in average household bills across the country. Local Government Minister Nanai Mahuta said the report confirms the need for major reform to upgrade and maintain water infrastructure and avoid unaffordable increases to household bills. She also said the government is now working with local government and iwi to combine local water service providers into a smaller number of publicly owned providers. Victoria University of Wellington's School of Government lecturer Dr. Julia Talbot-Jones said centralising water management powers could work both ways.
Well, the new figures shine light on the motivation behind undertaking reforms. The new reports released yesterday that you refer to estimate that between 120 and 185 billion of investment will be needed in water infrastructure by 2050. So whether or not the plan is the reforms take the intended approach outlined in these reports, or they need to take some other approach. Either way, amendments and changes to our water infrastructure are needed.
Why do we need the reforms in the first place? Is there a problem with the current way that New Zealand manages water?
Well, there's a big difference, let's be clear, about urban water and rural water and how those things are managed. In urban areas, one of the big challenges is that the way that we charge rates often don't account for the costs of upkeep of infrastructure. And so smaller councils haven't basically collected enough money and used it in a way to ensure that all the pipes that deliver water are kept up to date. And so this has meant that some councils have resulted in having very old and leaky infrastructure, while others have taken steps to make major improvements. Now, to ensure that over the next 30 years we don't end up with a completely crumbling system and one that affects drinking water in a way that's similar to what happened in Havelock North a few years ago, we definitely need to make some changes. And so at the moment we have 67 councils around New Zealand trying to manage their water, and what they're trying to do with these reforms is amalgamate some of those responsibilities in order to increase efficiency and improve the quality of service delivery.
But would centralising water infrastructure management work at resolving most of the existing problems that smaller councils face?
Well, I think that's the big question. The report draws on the experience in Scotland, which found that the amalgamation of management and control resulted in improvements both from an efficiency perspective and in terms of the quality of service delivery. One of the big questions that you always need to ask is, it's really useful pointing to successful examples, but we should also look more broadly and say, are there examples where amalgamation has not worked so well? None of those come to mind off the top of my head, but when it comes to water, undertaking massive reforms at a national level are not a particularly common occurrence.
But Auckland Mayor Phil Goff said while he understands and supports the government's wider objectives on water, there is no one-size-fits-all approach to water infrastructure management. He spoke to me earlier today. Mr. Mayor, I want to first know your thoughts on the Three Waters report by the government.
Well, I support the objectives of the government. There's a huge amount of investment, maybe up to $185 billion that needs to be made in water infrastructure. And for most councils around the country, that will be beyond their ability to pay. For Auckland, I think we're in a slightly different position. We have already amalgamated. We already provide water services to 1.7 billion people. So we're bigger than any of the proposed entities they're planning to set up. So what we want to have for Auckland is something that does not provide disruption, does not lose the shareholding by the people of Auckland in those water facilities, and does ensure that the water entity is accountable and is responsive to the wider public that elects us to council. So while we support the broad objectives, we also want to make sure that we have something that's fit for purpose for Auckland. And I think what Auckland needs is different from what the rest of the country needs, because we already have the scale, we've already done the amalgamation, and we already have the high quality of water services that the government wants for the rest of the country.
So I guess your position on local government ministers, local government minister Nanaia Mohuta's proposal of amalgamating 67 councils' powers to manage water infrastructure is Auckland won't be a part of this.
Well, we want to work closely with government, and to the extent possible, we do want to be part of the reform process that they're pushing. But what we don't want is some of the proposals that the effect of which on our provision of water would be to reduce the accountability and responsiveness of our water supply entity, and it would not provide some of the economic advantages of amalgamation, because we are already of a size that they say in their own report is the optimal size. So I think what you want is a fit-for-purpose solution for Auckland, as well as making the changes that may need to be made in other parts of the country where they don't have the scale and where they have had much greater problems with the quality of water and the lack of renewal of ageing infrastructure.
But what's the ideal situation for Auckland's water infrastructure should look like?
Well, what I think we need to do is, having got the scale and the professionalism in our water supply entity, we need now, and we've done work with the Water Industry Commission for Scotland, to push for greater productivity, so that we can ensure that the costs can be kept as low as possible at a time when, of course, with growth in Auckland as well as the renewal of assets, we've got a pressing demand for much higher levels of investment. In the long-term plan, which we have just put through our council, we're increasing the investment in our water services by $4 billion in the next 10 years. That's increasing it from 7.1 to 11.1 billion. But what we would like the government to do is to provide something like a guarantee so that we could borrow more for investment in infrastructure without exceeding the debt to revenue ratio constraints that exist on council today.
Right. So might just sum that up. Do you want the ideal situation in Auckland is for the local council to control water infrastructure supplies, but they could get money from the government?
What we're looking for is to have strong governance so that the water supply entity is responsive and accountable to the people of the region. We want to guarantee that the shareholding stays with the people of Auckland and won't be privatised. And what we would like the government to do is to provide a guarantee over additional borrowing for water care, so that we could borrow more to bring forward some of the infrastructure plans that might otherwise be delayed. If we had achieved those three objectives, we'd be very pleased with the reform.
But are you afraid that people on the outside would see if Auckland gets its way, it will be one law for the big cities and other laws, another way of doing things for the others?
No, because what we actually have is already the model for what the rest of New Zealand may be about to pick up. We already have done our amalgamation. We already have an economy of scale. Watercare is already bigger than the other three water entities that would be proposed for New Zealand will be if that amalgamation goes ahead. We're not asking for anything that the rest of the country would not be getting. In fact, it's likely that that any government assistance, such as the $750 million they've already put into it, that's gone to everywhere but Auckland. So it's not Auckland with its hand out for asking for things that other regions aren't getting. It's simply saying one size doesn't fit all, and let's not mess with a structure that is already working for Auckland. Let's simply improve that structure within the outline that we already have for it, which is to ensure that there is good governance control and that there is that drive for productivity that Watercare and Auckland Council are already committed to.
That was Auckland Mayor Phil Goff and earlier Victoria University of Wellington's Dr. Julia Talbot-Jones. Moving on.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Last Thursday, an Australian federal court ruled that the Australian government has a duty to care to reduce climate change impacts from new mine approvals. This comes after a group of New South Wales students brought about the case, claiming climate change impacts from Whitehaven Coal Limited's new mine expansion would threaten their futures. I spoke to Catherine Iorns McGallans about the ruling, who is a professor of environmental law at the Victoria University of Wellington. I began by asking about the case's significance and what it meant for new mine expansions.
This case is huge for recognising that governments, and ministers in this case, decision makers, owe a duty of care to future generations, not to cause them harm, and that includes through climate change effects.
The ruling is not binding, though, and Whitehaven Coal Limited have announced that they will work towards federal protection to allow the expansion. Do you think that this limits its ability to have substantial impacts?
The decision is binding in one sense, but not in another. So it's not binding on the coal company because this action was not taken against the coal company. So this is where you have to understand the different types of law involved. So you get some statutes, right, that Parliament passes. In this case, we've got a statute that enables a minister to make a decision, right? And but you also have what we call the common law, which judges have made, you know, for centuries. So, for example, negligence, you know, this duty not to cause harm to someone else, is something judges invented before there were parliaments. And we've got this law of negligence on our books that if you want to take an action, we call it a civil suit, against another person, could be your neighbour, you know, for example, you can say this person is causing me harm and they have a duty not to cause me harm. And you can, in this case, what they did, they were using that law and they tried to get an injunction, which is a mechanism to stop someone doing something in advance. Or mostly negligence says, you've caused me harm and now you need to pay me damages or fix it somehow. But judges control that law of negligence. So this case was an interesting mix, right? So it was a case against the minister and the children were arguing that the minister has a duty of care under negligence law not to cause the children harm in the future. They asked for an injunction to stop him making a decision to extend the coal mine, which he gets under a statute, because making that decision would cause them all that harm if he extended the coal mine. And so what was huge about this case is, so remember, there's two things going on. One, you're asking the judge recognises this duty of care. It's never been done before, so that's brand new to say that a minister owes children of the future, children now, but sort of an adult, you know, in the future, but because of what's going to happen in the future, owes them a duty not to harm them, and therefore, in the decision on whether to approve a coal mine, not to make that decision. And so there's one thing, you owe the duty, but the second thing is, what do you do if he does owe the duty? And they said the court has to prevent him from making the decision, has to order an injunction, prevent him from approving it. And the case, actually, they lost on that point. The judge agreed that he has this duty, and that's huge, and that's what people are celebrating, because no court has found that duty before in the same world. They have, not in Australia, they have, not in New Zealand, they haven't. They have done so in the Netherlands. This is where they, you know, they found that kind of duty to future generations, but not in Australia or New Zealand, and not in negligence law. So that is this major win. Now, what actually happened is, of course, the court said, yeah, but you haven't given us enough evidence as to why you need the injunction. And they didn't say that it wasn't possible. They said an injunction might be possible, but they've given a lot of conditions and tests for how you get an injunction, and they didn't meet them. They didn't give enough evidence to prove that point. So if you haven't proven it, unfortunately, you can't get your injunction. So the children didn't get their injunction. The minister can still make the decision. And one of the reasons the judge said they didn't get the injunction was because without that evidence, they said, well, what if the minister could still make could still fulfill his duty, or her, in this case, duty of care? What if the minister could still fulfill the duty of care, but with a different, you know, format of a decision? Maybe not just a blanket all on or all off. Maybe there's something in the middle that could be negotiated. And it's that kind of language that obviously the coal companies picked up on, going, well, let's help the minister make a decision that's in the middle, that allows us to do some kind of expansion, but still fulfill the duty of care to the children of the future. So that's why you've got something that looks incongruous. It's partly because of the type of laws involved, and then the type of action that was taken and what the judge said about it.
So do you think that this is something that may become more common worldwide if government and companies fail to act on climate change?
Yes. People are looking for ways to stop the juggernaut of destruction, right? It is true. And this, okay, so for people who haven't seen it, you might have seen an op-ed of like 800 words. Well, this case is 160 pages long. There's 50 pages just on the science of climate change, and then more again on the particular harms that they will cause to these children in the future, you know, such as the heat waves, the bushfires, you know, other direct impacts. There's, you know, the health impacts, and the judge goes into these in detail. So what's coming at people in the future is catastrophic. If we don't do something about it, it will make the world uncivilized. You know, people talk about the end of civilization. That's because chaos and conflict is what we call people being uncivilized. We have democracies, so we act in a civilized manner, right? That's all we're talking about. So if we all become uncivilized, yes, it'll be unmanageable. And of course, it's your parents, you know, the people in decision-making powers now that have benefited most from the use of these fossil fuels. So, very long answer to why, yes, it will become way more common in the future because people are looking for ways to stop the worst outcomes eventuating. And we know that we've got to do that really quickly. You know, once ice has started melting, it's really hard to stop it. We can't have an overshoot, for example, and then try and pull it back. We actually have to stop getting up to these warmer temperatures in the first place. There's no sort of techno fix after we've gone past the point of no return, right? So the way to do that is I love this phrase of throw a stick or a spanner in the works, a stick in the spokes or a spanner in the works of the juggernaut of destruction. And one way to do that is to take a case and just force someone to stop now before you get Parliament to agree on changes that are needed, for example, or a company thinking they can get away with making money just that little bit longer until they're forced to stop. And that's what these cases do. As soon as you see that, right, here's a novel duty of care, it was recognised in Australia, let's recognise that here. You know, you can't say it's exactly the same law in New Zealand as we do in Australia, even the common law, no, we develop it slightly differently, but that the basic, these ideas around recognising a novel duty of care, well, it's the same kinds of factors and considerations, and so our judges could look at that and go, okay, we could recognise that duty of care here, and yes, we'll, you know, when someone wants to take a case now based on that, they could do the same kind of thing.
On a bit of a larger scale, the 2020 budget set around $2.3 billion for carbon-reducing projects, which many climate activists have said is nowhere near enough. Do you think that the government is doing enough on climate change?
Look, I don't, I'll be honest, no. And the main thing is this is the problem, actually, with a democracy as a decision-making tool in what's effectively an emergency, right? We have a set of decision makers that has to please everybody or else they get voted out. So they're trying to balance off those who don't want to change with those who do. And I don't want to say you, this is maybe appealing to your student audience. Grey power votes more than students do, right? Think of if you want to get more change and more decision making more quickly, then you have to change the decision makers in a democratic system, because they have to all show that your voice is louder and stronger, so there is more political cost for not following your decision. But it's really hard to get those in the power who've been doing the same old for how many years to, you know, and where interests are entrenched. People have got investments and lives, you know, huge billions of dollars tied up in an existing status quo, and to get people to move that is really hard. So if they do the slightest little bit of change, then someone else comes down on them like a ton of bricks and threatens to vote them out. So, yeah, they're not doing enough. They're doing what they think they can get away with politically, right? And but that shouldn't be the criteria, should it? The decision makers should be doing what's absolutely necessary. But then, what happens if what's necessary, no one else, the person that holds your job, doesn't think you need to do it?
I'm disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside.
The Wire.
That was Victoria University of Wellington environmental law professor Catherine Iones-McGallans speaking on a recent court ruling in Australia that said Australian government has a duty to care to reduce climate change impacts from new mine approvals. Next, the National Party's mental health spokesman Matt Doocy says that there must be urgent action to support individuals suffering from eating disorders. In a press release yesterday, Doocy said that frontline workers have reported 2 to 3 times more cases over the past year, despite no change in support services. I spoke to the minister about a recent petition to government, which is advocating for more care and assistance for young people suffering with eating disorders. I began by asking what the petition meant and the issues that eating disorders posed in New Zealand.
Today I'll be receiving a petition on the forecourt of Parliament brought by Canterbury mum Rebecca Toms. Rebecca's story is a heartbreaking story. Her daughter Georgia has had an eating disorder. Georgia and Rebecca have failed to access appropriate treatment services that they need for the betterment of Georgia. And this seems to be a wider issue across New Zealand. It's a real concern being a parent to learn that our young people who desperately need eating disorder services are struggling to access them. There seems to be no specific funding for eating disorder services in New Zealand, no national strategy. And today, quite rightly, Rebecca Toms, in support of her daughter Georgia, is bringing this petition to ask Parliament to respond and ensure that eating disorder services get the appropriate funding that they deserve.
Do you know, or do we know, how many people this affects in New Zealand?
Well, I have seen some data that say there is over 300 people in New Zealand on waiting lists to access services. And, you know, I have been told in desperation by parents that when they take their children to get services, they've been told that their child is not close enough to death yet before they can access a service. And that can't be right in New Zealand. And quite rightly, we need to ensure the appropriate amount of funding is going into services, but a real focus on early intervention, that we get to people early who have an eating disorder and make sure that they get the support they need.
Why do you think that this issue's generally been overlooked and there's not enough funding for it?
Well, I think overall mental health has always come second to physical health. On top of that, if you were to look at drug and alcohol services, who always claim to be the poor second cousin of mental health services, well, eating disorder services just don't even seem to be on the radar. So quite rightly, we need to bring them into the light, give them profile, and realise these services are underfunded. There seems to be a growing demand, and we're urging the government to respond.
Is there a specific plan that your party would enact if you were in government to support this and to overcome it?
Well, what the National Party is calling for is an urgent inquiry into eating disorder services. We'd like an inquiry to look at how we can develop a national strategy for eating disorder services, to look at what types of services we need in New Zealand, the workforce to deliver it, and how we can ensure those services get earlier to people to make a real difference. Because ultimately, some of these people end up living with lifelong eating disorder, and we want to make sure they have the necessary services to go on, be treated, and be productive members of their communities.
Do you think that there should be more money committed to it?
Yes. I think what we've got to do is ensure that eating disorder services and the full range of mental health services in New Zealand are funded. We need to make sure our services not only treat people, but they promote well-being, so they get in early and they prevent some people going on to developing mental health issues and eating disorder issues.
The Labor government promised almost $2 billion in mental health spending since they've come into power, yet only a fraction of this has been spent. Where do you think the remainder should be spent?
Well, the government announced $1.9 billion for mental health in Budget 2019. We've since learned a large part of that remains unspent in mental health bank accounts overseen by Grant Robertson, the Finance Minister. What they need to do is urgently spend that money. We've got ballooning waiting times, whether it be child and adolescent services, eating disorder services. We need to make sure the money is getting to the grassroots and providing valuable services that New Zealanders need today.
That was National Party mental health spokesperson Matt Ducey speaking on increased support for individuals suffering from eating disorders.
Thanks, Louis. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia marunga irirangi pōho. You're tuned into 95BFM, and this is the Thursday Wire. Just remember, you still have some time to let me and Louis know what you think of our previous stories, and we've already got a couple of texts in, and we probably will read them out and just keep getting them in. The time is just up to 8 to 1 here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be going on another break.
Pack your marmalade sandwiches, because Paddington Bear's first concert is coming to Auckland Town Hall. From an original story by Michael Bond, follow everyone's favourite Peruvian bear on an adventure from meeting the Brown family at Paddington Station to his debut as a conductor at the Royal Albert Hall. Paddington Bear's first concert with the Auckland Philharmonia Orchestra at the Auckland Town Hall, Saturday, June 12th. Save with a family pass. Go to apo.co.nz.
Wow! Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
June features Aruj Aftab, Deep State, Fable, Terza and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We just got some texts about our earlier stories. The first one from our regular texter Peter. 1,000 years will pass and you guys will still believe that government is the answer to the world's problems when government is the reason why these problems continue. While Grizzy said, unfortunately, the companies that lobby political parties are the companies causing the most damage to the planet. They are only about making money now and don't care about anything else, let alone the future. We are all connected on this planet. Keep those ticks or calls coming in.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā. And that's all for the Thursday Wire for today. The first one for the second half of 2021, on June 3rd. Nā te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero ki a mātou mō tēnei rā. Thank you to those who spoke to us today. We've got Health Minister Andrew Little, Auckland Mayor Phil Goff, Catherine Ions McGellans and Dr. Julia Talbot-Jones from Victoria University in Wellington, as well as Nationals MP and mental health spokesperson Matt Ducey. And also a big thanks to my producer Louis McAllister. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. We will be back next week. Enjoy the rest of your working week and over the long weekend. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.